Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Before I introduce the briefly the panelists whom you know, let me try and describe what we'll try and do with you in the next hour and a half. This is the wrap-up panel. And there won't be any kind of Talmudic attempt to sum up everything we have discussed, but we shall try that in writing a report of this conference next week. So really, we would welcome final comments from the floor on a lot of the issues. The only thing that I'll do now is just to recall for us some of the salient points that have, themes that have come across this space in the last 30-odd hours. The other purpose of the panel, and my panelist companions will address this, is to offer a way forward, which is to some extent a question of process, I guess, but they're going to try and approach it in a way, I hope, as non-conventional as possible. The panelists whom you know, Charles Doran, I think it was Alan Gottlieb who wrote, I think I read it in something Alan wrote, I don't see Alan here, Alan said that every good nation needs a psychiatrist. Charles wrote a book, there comes Alan, 25 years ago, called Canada, the United States, The Forgotten Partnership, and sent us all neurotically off for counseling. When I was in Washington 25 years ago, 30 years ago, Charles was already called the Dean of American Canadianists. And here he is still the Dean of American Canadianists. So if anybody can psychoanalyze us, it's the distinguished, I've forgotten what your title of professorship is, but it's obviously a very grand and intelligent benefactor who set it up, Charles, and we're very happy to have you with us. Colin Robertson used to be the smartest Foreign Service officer Canada had, and now he's just Colin Robertson, you know. He got too smart for the Department of Foreign Affairs, thereby proving Alan Gottlieb's thesis that we have to upgrade our assets. In fact, as Colin's example shows, we're running them down. But Colin is here as part of our California, British Columbia, West Coast theme, because he was an extremely successful, with his wife, Canadian Consul General in Los Angeles. Before going on, really to try to reinvent the practice of public diplomacy in Washington, Colin was wooing somebody said, it may have been Bob Pastor, that the trouble is that Canada doesn't have any kind of, there's no Canadian caucus in Congress. Well, we did create one, actually, Bob, until we found out that the people who live along the border hate us. You know? So, gee, we put that one away. But anyway, Colin was sent down to make them love us, and he's a lovable guy. And the fact that it didn't work is not his fault. He's still a lovable guy. Anne McClellan has been the most powerful woman in Canadian politics in my generation. You were minister of almost everything, including health, a hell of a good minister of health, for those of you who talk about health care. She did it. She was Minister of Justice. She's been a Dean of Law prior to coming into Parliament. I think you were there for about 13 years. 13 years as a Liberal from Edmonton, for God's sake. That in itself is some accomplishment. And then Anne McClellan was Deputy Prime Minister of Canada. And as Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, she was in the wake of 9/11. I guess that was in the Martin government, wasn't it? So it's a little after the wake of 9/11, as we were getting beaten up, she also assumed the responsibilities for public safety and security. Henry Brady is one of those really odd ducks. He's a very important American. He's president of the American Political Science Association. He directs the Goldman School of Public Policy here, which is an outstanding school. He has a hell of a lot to think about, and yet he sometimes thinks about Canada. So we try not to think about why he does that. We just love him for it, okay? And Henry is a great scholar, and it's been one of my pleasures here at Berkeley to know him. So that's the panel. Here's the setup. We have sat through a day and a half of stuff which has a dark side. I think that Ambassador Gottlieb defined the dark side in its kind of strategic reality, which fundamentally is that Canadians feel screwed. We took tremendous political risks in the late 80s, ran a national election on free trade. We secured free trade in the expectation that it was going to take vital Canadian interests out of domestic constituencies in the United States and use a rational system and enable us to have a just-in-time border that would permit the growth of the two economies in sync. And for a variety of reasons, as Alan said, 9/11 happened. But Americans lost, or the United States government lost, its sense of strategy, a strategic importance about Canada. And that it is necessary for us either to get that back or to do something else. And that is what we have heard, and that sits here like an elephant in the room, because it's undeniably true what was said. Now, some Americans, in commenting on that in the last few days, I counted the number of times, or the number of topics to which the word dysfunctional was applied. Congress is dysfunctional. We heard about how American economics is dysfunctional. Don't expect us, we heard, to try and make the Canada-U.S. economic relation functional. We can't make our own economy functional. We heard, and I dispute it, that American foreign policy is dysfunctional. We heard all about climate change policies. We heard in a different sense from Bob Pastor, and I agree with him, that the dual bilateral relationships are also dysfunctional, but that is another kind of dysfunction. So we heard a lot of dysfunction, and some of the comments were that, look, you know, we know the border's thickened. We know you've gotten screwed, but there's no point in discussing us with us. It's the wrong moment. No one's interested in Canada. So we heard that. You can balance that against what Roberta Jacobson said, which I thought sounded to me very authentic, that we would like to hear some proposals from Canada. We are busy. Let's have those proposals. And from Tom Pickering, I thought we had an enormously strong start. He talked about one facility borders. He talked about what Alan called the holy grail of binding arbitration. But he was the first to talk about the Arctic as a zone of cooperation that then Franklin took up with such so impressively. And he also mentioned energy, and which I thought that the business this morning about energy and the smart trilateral grid thing is an enormously rich topic if you believe, as several people said, that that functional integration is the way you have to go. You can't, because we had in the first panel yesterday the basic perception, and Jack reiterated this yesterday afternoon, that fundamentally North Americans don't identify themselves as North Americans. But on the other hand, we felt, though there was some dissent, and it depends how you interpret the numbers, but we felt that basically, at least between Canadians and Americans, there weren't vast differences, but that to give them a sense of community, you had to do important things together. So I thought that was very interesting. Roberta Jacobson said, and several others said, and I thought it was true, that it has to come from the top. As a democratic activist, we hate top-down stuff. We're bottom-up people. But I recognize that with respect to this, it needs top-down leadership. The question in Canada, and I don't mean this personally or politically, is whether because of the minority government or vision or whatever, that is simply available at any time in the near future. So I'm going to turn, I don't know, there are other topics. We discussed foreign policy in several respects, whether or not Canada's, the fact that the Obama administration is announcing a multilateralist approach to foreign policy, which emphasizes consultation with allies in a world in which American power is at least in a sort of proportional or relative way, I don't like the word diminished, but America needs allies, whether or not Canada has a particular opportunity in a world that's becoming more web-based and wider to be of significant relevance to the United States and thereby improve its political capital to deploy on these vexing bilateral issues. And that remains a very large topic. So I'll quit and pass it on to you folks. But I hope that these big topics that you will take up, the panel will take them up, and you'll take them up afterwards, so that when we finish this thing, we'll know where we've been. Okay? Thank you very much. Let's start with Colin, who put a paper out. Okay? Thanks.
Thanks, Jeremy. This being the last session, I'd just like to start off almost where we started, that this wouldn't have taken place, this conference, without the vision of someone who isn't here, and of course that's Tom Barnes. And I'd like to just pay respect once more. When I was Consul General, we came up here, and with Rita and Nelson and others, we got the Canadian Studies program really going thanks to money, which in part came from government and then from a beneficiary to the UC system. The other person I want to pay tribute to, of course, is Alan Gottlieb, who has been a huge influence on me throughout my career and who remains the maestro when it comes to Canada-U.S. relations. My very first posting, I was one of what those of us were sent out called Gottlieb's babies. He had was our then deputy minister, and he had recognized in the wake of the failure of the East Coast Fisheries Agreement that we had to acknowledge the important role of that dysfunctional branch you call Congress. But so a number of us junior officers were dispatched to consulates around the United States to get to know congressmen. I was particularly fortunate. I got to go to New York and meet people like Christopher Dodd, who'd just been elected, Jacob Javits, and to spend time with people like Daniel Patrick Moynihan. So it was formative, and I owe it, and much of what I've learned to Alan, who's both his more recent memoir and his particular, his I'll be with you in a minute, Mr. Ambassador. I used to keep a copy on my desk when I was in Washington and one at home because it was a constant reference. And much of this is influenced by what he has said. Well, Canada is unique among major industrialized countries in that we only have one very visible neighbor. We always feel that Americans need to know more about us without acknowledging that we don't know as much about them as we think we do. From Confederation on, Canadians have always been anxious to keep Uncle Sam at arm's length. Since 9/11, Uncle Sam has been more than happy to agree, creating a real border. Now we want back into America's embrace, or at least into its pockets, so that we can share in the spectacular gains we've made from value chains, industry, and investment. Protecting our gains will require a smart approach to integration, including a complementary approach in immigration and refugee policy, harmonization of standards and regulations, and a robust security arrangement that includes law enforcement, intelligence sharing, and adding maritime and land forces to our continental air defense arrangement. I think for the United States, it means spending a bit of time on a neighbor that has increasingly become the near abroad. Canadians can make progress if we keep in mind the following lessons. First, be bold, as referred to earlier, Burnham's part about thinking big. Americans respond to big ideas, not small ball, as George W. Bush put it. Tone matters. This is something Alan's always said, particularly at the top, work relationships at every level, governments, business, labor, knowledge networks like what we're doing today, and civil society. Three, stay focused and set visible milestones. Public pressure is a mighty incentive for bureaucrats and politicians. Experiment regionally, recognizing that one size does not fit all. Four, we have a global network. Use it, resource it, and leverage our relationship as interpreter and helpful fixer vis-a-vis America and the rest of the world. And that's how we could become what Tom Pickering called a first mover. And remember, for Canadian interests in the United States, it is a permanent campaign requiring 1,000 points of contact. And now I'm going to give you my Decalogue. This is something also Alan taught us, is put things down into 10 points people will remember. First, for America, we are not a problem requiring attention. Yet for Canada, our interests with the United States are vast, deep, and growing daily. We have to get this relationship right, and it's incumbent on us to take the initiative. The responsibilities of global primacy and an increasing preoccupation with domestic concerns means that Canada must be even more creative in making its case in Washington and in harnessing the strengths of the different levels of government. Come back to the sub-regional. We have to make our own breaks, but it would be nice if we had someone listening at the other end. We can't take our well-being in North American space for granted. Continued incrementalism means eventual decline. So smart, bold partnerships on energy, the environment, labor mobility, regulatory standards, and perimeter management, particularly in the north, are what we have to do to advance our joint interests. Three, security is the abiding American preoccupation. As Ambassador Jacobson said a couple of weeks ago, 9/11 changed things. There's no going back. We must be their safest and most reliable partner. Progress on all other files begins with security. The United States needs a high level of confidence that we're watching their back. And that's why when asked yesterday, my elevator pitch, I said we have to be a good ally, a reliable ally. We want from the United States for them to be a good neighbor. We watch their back and to be consistently reminded that we are a reliable partner in collective security. This is probably going to mean some more tough decisions on where we go in Afghanistan. An example of some place where I think we could be helpful is if we produce about a quarter of the world's uranium. And nuclear proliferation is at the top of President Obama's agenda, as it is for most presidents. And if we were to be stewards of that uranium that we mine in northern Saskatchewan, and from cradle to putting it back into the mines, I think that would make a contribution to international security. Four, we need to cultivate 1,000 points of contact, the administration, Congress, the states and cities, and the relationships between business and labor. We sometimes forget a third of the Canadian labor unions are affiliates of American unions, including the United Steelworkers, who've taken the lead on the whole Buy America. Interestingly enough, led by a Canadian. We should have a presence in every American state using our network of star-spangled Canadians, Jeffrey Simpson's term, and the subject of his book, working in the local chambers of commerce and reporting through our hub of existing consulates and our embassy in Washington. Five, the key element in what I call the hidden wiring of connections at the state and province level is the relationship between premiers and governors. Premiers and governors, in my view, are consistently ahead of the curve in their appreciation of Canada-U.S. relationships. We have a former premier sitting in front of us, and Pierre Marc. He gets it. Last month, the premiers met governors at the winter meeting of the National Governors Association and began to constructively discuss how, for example, to implement the reciprocity agreement on government procurement. Regular meetings between the National Governors Association and Council of the Federation would temper protectionist instincts by underlining the best customer relationships between states and provinces. As Tip O'Neill said, all politics is local. More can be done at the state-province level. They are incubators for change. Laboratories was the word used earlier. Look at the smart driver's license, the brainchild of Premier Campbell and Washington Governor Gregoire to deal with the border traffic around the Olympics. They designed the new license to meet security requirements and then, working through Congress and the administration, persuaded Homeland Security, and this was under Chertoff times, to adopt it as an alternative for land travel at the border. Now they're looking to see if they can't do the same thing for pre-clearance, rail, and sea. Six, Canadian resources are central to American energy security. Withholding them is a hollow threat and would only threaten our own unity. But as Tom points out, efforts to discount dirty oil should be fiercely resisted as protectionism wrapped in green. A joint bilateral approach to carbon management, something that Jeffrey Simpson has written about, makes a lot of sense. Hydroelectricity is an important Canadian card. It's clean, it's there, and it's what the smart grid needs, as was remarked on earlier this morning. Commence planning to build a pipeline from the oil sands to the West Coast to diversify and open markets with Asia. Water, I'm convinced, will emerge as the most important resource issue in the 21st century. You can't live in California without being aware of water. It's a challenge, but it's also an opportunity for business development, particularly in clean water technology and sustainability. Seven, governments must resist the temptation to over-regulate, and I think this is a danger particularly now. Business and labor need to recognize that the change situation requires them to improve their own game and step up for the common good. Political leadership must be vigilant to the bureaucratic instinct to control and over-regulate. With 33 years in the bureaucracy, I can tell you that is the temptation. Risk management coupled with good intelligence is the better way to ensure the beneficial flow of people and trade. Canadian universities and think tanks need to develop knowledge centers around critical aspects of the U.S. and develop closer relationships to the United States. This conference today is a superb example of making that happen. And make maximum use of the star-spangled Canadians that are here in the United States. Eight, our successful and continuing historical experiment with pluralism gives us both a remarkable asset and position of responsibility to, as the world goes global. We can be the bridge between nations and linchpin across the world. The diversity of our population, and especially the networks that we gain through immigration, gives us standing and ability to think big on the major developments of our time, like the rise of China and India, as David Emerson pointed out, and climate change. We need to further develop our relationships, especially with China and India, and take full advantage of the migration that is giving us membership and presence in the greater Chinese and Indian diaspora. Since 1980, half the migration to Canada comes from Asia. These are both ends in themselves, but also a means to influence the United States, who is now curiously interested in what's going on. Nine, like it or not, we live in a world where change takes place quickly, unpredictably, and in a sequence of rapid, disruptive events that requires and obliges agility and resiliency. Our global diplomatic service gives us a different perspective. Alan talked about this yesterday with the example of Robert Ford. Particularly in places like Cuba, and the quiet work we're doing in development, for example, through training judges and policemen in Mexico, Afghanistan, and other places, in the rule of law and importance of governance. Our relationship with the United States gives us a unique influence as interpreter of America to the world and to America on the world. Played effectively, our global relationships have immense value both in themselves and in reinforcing Canadian sense of who we are and what we represent as a nation. Diplomacy, especially in an increasingly multi-centric world, is going to make a comeback as we return to a concert of powers. Again, something both Alan and Tom Pickering commented on yesterday. But it's got to be diplomacy with a difference, agile with acuity and autonomy, as much public as private, with an emphasis on grassroots and networks using technology. This is what will allow what Tom called a first mover capacity. 10. Success demands bold leadership and vision, but it starts at the top with Prime Minister and President. Inscribed in the paneling of the old cabinet rooms in Parliament Hill is a biblical verse, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." Finally, a question for our American friends. We say we have a special relationship, but we say that about lots of others as well. While the United States is our only neighbor, to the United States, are we more than just the northern neighbor or something more? We would rank very high with the United States as a fair trade partner. Americans like us more than any other country. We play together, we fight together, we work together. The Buy America exception is in some ways a throwback to pre-NAFTA days in our relations, when we would seek a Canada exemption. Yet in the Buy America deal is the kernel of something else, perhaps, one that defines our bilateral relationship in terms of 63 states and provinces. If there is a continental relationship, I think that is where it begins to change, again, this state-province relationship. And that's where I think we have to explore, is there room for a Canadian exemption? Can we create, I was at Washington two nights ago, and John Negroponte said to me, what you've really got to do is create a secure competitiveness, base it on a Canada-U.S. relationship that allows for docking when Mexico is ready. Do not leave Mexico out of this equation. Or are things like the Buy America deal done purely for short-term reasons? If so, are we therefore doomed to incrementalism around a thickening border? That is a question for all of us. Thank you.
At the outset of this conference, Alan Gottlieb very properly lamented the lack of vision regarding the problems North America is facing in the coming years, and correspondingly also lacking the sense of what the proposed solutions should be. Tom Pickering said, and I remember exactly, I wrote it down, I quote, what is it that the two of us, Canada and the United States, could do together that would have a win-win outcome? Now, in a modest way, I'd like to focus on one aspect of this, which cuts across the whole series of the panels. So maybe I can pull these together at the same time. What I will try to do is to outline this specific problem and therefore a specific solution, maybe as an example of looking forward. And it's an institutional solution, which I think fits in the framework of what we're talking about as well. What it does is it builds on Franklin Griffith's excellent presentation, which I'm going to use as a kind of a springboard. Now, let me start out with the assumptions which underlie this. You may or may not agree with these. The first assumption is, and the focus is of all of this, is going to be on the Arctic, which I think is an issue that this conference has certainly shown is becoming more and more important, but we still have time to deal with it. The first point, then, is, as an assumption, is that the Arctic is melting at an astonishing rate. I think that Dan Kamen's little film illustrates this. Remember the very large open patches of water, especially on the Russian side, but also on the American, Canadian, European side. So this happened in 20 years, and he said that the rate of this could be increasing, but in any case, the consequences of it are already incredibly obvious to us. Second thing that I assume is that the number of oil and gas operations along the Arctic littoral number in the hundreds, and they're going to increase. This is the boom area in many respects for these operations. And in addition, I looked at a map on this, the number of mining operations that are proposed is really quite astonishing. Now, all of these are going to have to be serviced from these oceans. This will involve transit of gear and of product. Third assumption that I'm making here is that these proposed international transit routes are opening up in a number of areas, especially along the Russian side. That was the part that had the huge open area, but in fact along the Canadian-American side as well. And what is interesting is that others outside of the those who have the ownership, as it was expressed, of parts of the Arctic. Others are becoming vastly interested in this. Why else would we have China, Japan, and Germany wanting to be observers? Why else would we have Germany building an icebreaker, on a very, very expensive icebreaker? The conclusion I come to is that they are thinking about links between Europe and Asia, or Asia and Europe, and the Arctic is going to be the route that's going to be used because it's shorter. They're going to save especially days of travel, but they also are going to save a lot of energy in the process. Now, what does that all add up to? What I think it adds up to is this, that there's going to be a large problem of security management. A large problem of security management, and that we, Canadians and Americans, are going to have to deal with that. Now, I also am assuming, fourth thing, that Canada has a series of forward-looking proposals to establish environmental regulation. After all, some in this room were in the lead in putting forward the economic zone, for example. But I think there are other things that are including this, including laying claim to the resources in the Canadian jurisdiction. And I think this could probably become a model for others in the Arctic as well. But there's one area where Canada and the United States disagree, where interests, in fact, I think, clash. And that is the approach to Arctic security. What's the briefest possible way, what is the difference in perspective here? Well, I think Canada believes in trying to expand its very legitimate claims to sovereignty, and at the same time to reject any notion, at least in its nearby waters, of international straits. I think the United States wants to maintain unfettered access to these waters, as in any international straits, for its maritime and naval fleets, and especially for its submarine passage. Britain, of course, is supportive of this, and there are others as well. Closure here would establish a legal precedent that would have significance for Malacca, for example, and particularly for Hormuz, where 70% of the exportable oil and natural gas for the foreseeable future will come. So the American view is that this issue is critical in a much larger sense. The Arctic is melting. How do we square these apparently, seemingly, contrasting and opposing viewpoints? Ledger domain will not work. For decades, Canada and the United States have worked together successfully in the most unique institution the world has seen, in my judgment, and that's called NORAD. In fact, these two countries and their representatives have worked with perfect trust, responsibility, and with effectiveness inside this organization. And this organization has, in fact, provisions for maritime responsibility. That was added fairly recently. Now, the argument that I'd like to put on the table that in a sense cuts across so many of these panels, but particularly focuses on the Arctic, is this. if both Canada and the United States monitor and provide security jointly through the auspices of this NORAD extension, I think many benefits would follow. First thing is, there'll be huge cost savings, and one should never underestimate the cost of monitoring and, in fact, enforcing security in this hostile and difficult environment. Secondly, I think the degree of surveillance and the effectiveness of that surveillance, both for the United States and for Canada, would be much higher if, in fact, they jointly worked on this project together in the way that they so effectively did inside NORAD. Thirdly, since each of them will share information, there would be no need for prior notification or for the surfacing, for example, of submarines. I don't think I have to elaborate on this point. Fourthly, the United States and Canada will not have to face a noisy and possibly very disruptive and I think ultimately disappointing legal hassle over the Straits issue, where in the end perhaps both will end up losing. Fifth, Canada and the United States, if they decided to do this, would build on their common institutional history to achieve a win-win solution. All that is required for this policy implementation, I believe, is vision, the kind of vision that Alan Gottlieb was talking about. Vision both in Ottawa and Washington to put this common institutional initiative into practice. Thank you.
And do you wish to speak at the podium or speak?
I don't want to speak from here.
You don't want to own the podium?
I do not.
But
I think we did that pretty effectively, although for normally, I suppose, deferential Canadians, the whole concept of owning the podium maybe was a little aggressive. But anyway, thanks so much, Jeremy. It is a great pleasure to be here with all of you, and I have certainly enjoyed this past 2 days. What I want to do, Jeremy, is just offer some points of view, I call them atmospherics, if you like, that I worked with and through and under during the period of time in which I was in federal politics in Canada, some 13 years, working with two prime ministers and two presidents and two homeland security secretaries and so on and so forth. And my comments really, I suppose, if they in fact respond to either of the two presentations, more to Collins than to Charles. But first of all, let me say, we've been talking a lot about optimism and pessimism on, you know, the scale. I think Alan Gottlieb has perhaps unfairly been viewed as, you know, the Darth Vader over here on the far end of the pessimism scale, and Paul Heinbecker, which is somewhat unusual for Paul, over here as you know, the eternal optimist. I, being a Canadian Big L liberal, put myself firmly in the middle between the two, which is where liberals from Canada, at least, feel the most comfortable most of the time. A number of points. First of all, in relation to our relationship with the United States, the world did change on 9/11. And I think it has taken Canada much longer than it should have to realize just how much things changed. And there are times when you think that Canadians and Americans, at least in certain places at certain levels, are like ships passing in the night. They are speaking different languages around the nature of the change after 9/11 and the appropriate responses there too. And I think there's actually a reason for this that people don't often analyze closely enough. For Canadians, the primary lens with which we looked at everything after 9/11 was an economic security lens. We saw the border close on 9/11, and that was very traumatic for us. So we looked at what had to happen after 9/11, primarily through an economic security lens, but not exclusively. Obviously, we also understood that we were dealing with physical security, in brackets, national security issues, but primarily an economic security lens. The United States has looked at everything since 9/11 from a physical security slash national security lens. And of course they looked at the border and realized the trucks weren't moving and there was $1 million disappearing every minute at the Windsor-Detroit border crossing. But it wasn't their primary lens. Their primary lens was about the homeland, the securing of the homeland, making sure there would not be another attack on the homeland in which Americans would lose their lives. And I think if we understand the fact that we came at this trying to appreciate each other's perspective, but from a different primary perspective, I think you will understand why we see the growing frustration on both sides of the border. And why, for example, Janice, when you talk about a thicker border, Canadians' reaction to that is negative. That is bad. Many of you in this room know Scotty Greenwood. Scotty Greenwood, who works in Washington with the, Canada-U.S. Business Council? She says that Americans, when they hear that the Canadian-U.S. border is thickening, they see that as a positive good. They see it as representing greater security, greater protection from the homeland. We talk different languages to some extent here. And I think that, and here I'm speaking as a Canadian, I think we do not always appreciate the difference of perspective and then how that plays out in real actions at our borders, land, sea, airports, and elsewhere. And why, for example, if you look at a December 25th event, I have not done a scientific survey, but just talking to people in Canada and Europe, most people, I think, feel that what happened after December 25th, and as it related to reactions in the U.S., was an overreaction. Whereas in the United States, the reaction was one of, oh my heavens, we haven't learned anything from 9/11. Perhaps both reactions are wrong, but I think we need to, or at least extreme, but I think we need to understand those reactions because they play out in very concrete ways around Canada-U.S. relations and to a lesser extent Canada-U.S.-Mexican relations. My next point. Canadians don't always listen to what the United States is saying or trying to tell us. I think we are at times tone deaf. And here, I use a couple of examples. One, obviously yesterday with Roberta Jacobson. Isn't it interesting, Roberta talked about Afghanistan, Jeremy, at least twice. Put it specifically in play twice. Now, there are no active Canadian politicians here, but there are a lot of former politicians and diplomats from Canada here. I would hope, and first of all, I'm not suggesting that this comes as a surprise to politicians in Ottawa, that the Americans are interested in what will happen or what our actions will be after 2011. But I thought it very interesting that Roberta put it in play twice yesterday in a very interesting way. Also, Roberta said yesterday, and you referenced this, Jeremy, it's time, or perhaps the time is propitious, for Canada to take the lead on something, to step up to the plate. Maybe now is the time. Interestingly, and Canadians here generally say, oh, well, you know, if we do that, the Americans won't pay attention. I'll give you a perfect example of where Americans paid attention, and it played to our advantage and America's enormously, in the 3 months after 9/11. John Manley, then Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, this is a well-known story, went to Washington, talked to Andrew Card, then Chief of Staff to George W. Bush. And John said, we're really concerned about the border. This border can't close. If something else bad happens, we've got to keep the border open. And this was in the weeks immediately following 9/11. Andrew Card quite rightly said to John Manley, you know what? We don't know whether there's going to be another attack. We don't know where it's going to come from or when. We don't have the time or resources to put together a plan that would keep the border open in the future. Why don't you do that? And John Manley came back to Ottawa, worked across departments and with officials, put together what became the Smart Border Declaration and then the Smart Border Action Plan. And that was a situation in which the Americans said to us, take the lead, do this work, and we will be interested in it. And in fact, what happened was that George W. Bush's administration accepted the plan virtually without a comma change or any substantive change to the plan as proposed. Now, of course, Canadian officials were working closely with U.S. officials. But at the highest level, it was Canada, you run with this ball because we've got other preoccupations and we're not going to be able to run with it, but we think it's a good idea. And the other example I give of Canadians not listening is something I heard at a trilateral conference some months ago in Ottawa, Canada, U.S., Mexico, where a very senior U.S. State Department official said, and I paraphrase, but pretty much this is what this official said, Mexico matters to the United States. I don't understand what Canada doesn't understand about that. What is it Canada doesn't get? If Mexico matters to the United States, then Mexico better matter to Canada. He put it just a little bit more gently. But I ask, who is listening back home? Because if we're not listening, there will be more ugly surprises, and then our feelings will be hurt, and we'll whine about the fact that we're losing our special relationship with the United States. And let me just deal with that. I think Alan Gottlieb is right. There was a special relationship, probably after the World War II. Up until when, Alan? You know, it could be the end of the Cold War, but let's even push it up further. Let's, you know, maybe up till even 2000, although the relationship was waning. And part of what Canadians didn't get was that it was waning. And we kept invoking special relationship. You know what? Again, there's a bit of a tone deafness here. Politicians sometimes think if you just say something long enough and loud enough, it will be. But what we as Canadians failed to do was actually look at the whole thing from the perspective of the Americans. Did the Americans think that there was a special relationship? And if so, how did the Americans define it in the world post-Cold War, post-Bill Clinton, 2000, post-9/11? We never actually put ourselves inside the minds or tried to get inside the minds. The United States. Now, Colin probably did, but you weren't an elected politician. But at the elected politician level, but I would say even at the official level, were we really trying to get inside and figure out rather than just go around and stamp our feet like spoiled children and say, we have a special relationship, why aren't we getting more respect in Washington? Maybe we should have tried to look at this from the perspective of the United States and the pressures on the United States and their agenda and whether or not this was a special relationship and if so, of what kind or dimensions. And here again, Mexico does have a special relationship with the United States. I'm not saying we necessarily don't, but they do, for some of the reasons we heard. People in Canada do not understand the fragility of the Mexican democratic experience, and therefore they do not understand why the United States is so preoccupied at the highest levels in maintaining, sustaining, and buttressing the democratic project in Mexico. And we can help them. You know, we talk a lot about multilateralism and, you know, using our skill sets and whatever. Well, here is something that is so obvious, I don't understand why we're not down there doing more. Because, but again, it's because we don't understand in Canada at the highest levels how fragile the Mexican democratic exercise is. And on top of that, how important it is to the United States. The U.S. will not let Mexico slip away. And therefore, that has direct implications for us, and we're missing the boat, as far as I'm concerned, in relation to that. Now, domestic politics, at least for some period of this time. We've talked a lot here about leadership on a whole host of issues, whether it's the Arctic, borders, whatever. Absolutely, leadership is so important. Tone at the top, vision. However, leadership has been difficult for a significant part of this period of time. Let me just take a small slice of this time. Since 2004, Canada has had minority governments. Around the time that we did the Security, Prosperity, and Partnership Agreement, which Roberta and Robert and others have said was not as bold as it should have been, it didn't have the resources, human or financial, behind it. Well, why was that? It was because of the domestic political situations in the three countries and the limitations. Paul Martins was a minority government. President Bush, getting toward the end of his time, well, into his second term, but facing a revolt on immigration reform. This was not the time for George Bush to go back to Washington and say, oh, by the way, I've just signed a brand new aggressive, integrative, trilateral deal with Canada and Mexico. Because the people, the domestic politics in the United States would not have permitted that. Right now, you've got an overwhelmed Barack Obama, in spite of all his best intentions. In Mexico, you've got a weakened Calderon. He won his election by less than 1%. And last July, he lost big in the midterm elections to PRI. There's a serious question as to whether he is anything more than a lame duck president for the last half of his presidency. And so domestic politics matters here in terms of when you call for leadership, when you ask for vision. Absolutely. David Emerson and I would agree, as former elected politicians, we should be courageous. We should step out. We should articulate the tough vision. But there is a reality of domestic politics in all three countries that have actually constrained the kind of leadership that I think people either crave or have been calling for here. And Jeremy, very briefly, let me conclude. The importance of regional trading blocs. They're going to get more important, not less important. And here I do not mean to become a proponent or for Jeff Rubin. But Jeff Rubin wrote a little book called Something to the Effect Your World is About to Get a Whole Lot Smaller. And Jeff Rubin makes the point in that book, and this is, I think, one of his more interesting and compelling points, and it is now being made by many, many other people. And that is that regional trading blocs will become more important, not less important, because we will go back to a world of $150 or $200 a barrel oil. Now, nobody knows if this will happen. It's a theory, it's a hypothesis. But my guess is that we will see oil go into the triple digits in the next whenever. I'm not going to say when, that Tom Huffaker's sitting here. He would know more about that than me. But if you accept the fact that demand, as the economy, the global economy comes back, demand goes up, we have an interesting set of supply issues, some of which were alluded to this morning, transportation costs will go through the roof. Therefore, it may not look quite as attractive to outsource everything we've outsourced in North America, and it may not look so attractive to buy quite as many goods produced by cheap labor in China as it has appeared to be over the past number of years. Now, obviously, labor costs are going up in China, developing middle class, higher transportation costs if oil goes to $150 a barrel. How those things work out, one cannot say. But the basic theory, I think, is one we need to watch, which leads me to argue for the fact this is not a time for Canada to walk away from their friends in Mexico and the concept of a stronger, more integrated regional trading bloc. And here, whether it's smart grid, whether it's energy and the environment, the two together, I think that we see, or potentially will see, much more competitive advantage from working to further integrate in sensible ways this regional trading bloc than perhaps, at least in Canada, we have seen over the past number of years. And I do remind people that there are other groups in the world, the ASEAN nations, for example, working hard right now to create a more integrative regional trading bloc along with China's not a part of the ASEAN nations or Japan or South Korea, but the ASEAN nations working with those countries and working among themselves, tighter, integrative, regional trading bloc. And it just seems to me it's very short-sighted on our part to throw out, and here I exaggerate, but throw out the North American regional trading bloc and not look at how we can move forward in sensible and, dare I say, acceptable ways to our three, the people who live in our three countries. And this, of course, then requires political leadership, vision, and courage to step forward and make these arguments. And I've already explained why I don't think this is a propitious time for much of that. Anyway, I will conclude there. I know, Jeremy, you wanted us to be forward-looking, and I think to a considerable extent I have been, in that I think there are signs and signals that should, in my opinion, point us in a certain direction. And here I am not arguing for a minute that the bilateral relationship between Canada and the U.S. is not important and will not continue to be important. Of course it will. What I am suggesting, however, is a blind, almost obsessive approach to the invocation of special relationship with the U.S. and a pushing to one side of the Mexicans and the potential of a competitive, productive regional trading bloc will not serve any of us well and will most certainly not serve Canada well. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I suddenly realized what I've been missing in Canadian politics. Thanks for reminding me. Dr. Brady. Tough.
Hit the nail on the head. Let's face it, the problem is Canada just doesn't understand us. I've been feeling this for years. And Anna, you know, it would take a woman to really begin to understand, yeah, we're difficult, we can be hard to live with, but the truth is you just really haven't understood us and what we're all about. So just work harder at that.
But
and I think
you understand who pays the bills a lot of the time.
Okay.
That would be the U.S.
That would be the U.S. Okay, see? It's real simple here. Thank you. I almost don't have anything to say after all that. And if you just work harder at understanding us, everything would be fine. Let me talk about three themes that sort of caught my attention. First, we started with identity, and I just want to say a few words about that. Then I want to talk about what did I learn, and then third, maybe just how we might proceed and go forward. Let's talk about identity. We started with the first session on that, and I think what we showed was that there's a lot of common values. Yeah, you could say there's differences, and there certainly are, and so forth. But also, let's just think of a map and start thinking about if you go from Mexico through the city, the Mexican city of Los Angeles, as we learned, up through the Southwest, through Arizona, and Texas and so forth. So we have Mexican, American cultures bleeding into one another, then up through the prairies, which are ultimately indistinguishable when you get up to the north, the Great Lakes, which we share with Canada, and have done pretty well at that, by the way, too, sharing the Great Lakes for quite a while. Then the French Canadians of New England, the stock from which I come from on my mother's side, hence the name Henry. which is from my French-Canadian grandfather, over to Maine and the Maritimes. I mean, there is just a lot of bleeding together across this geography. And I haven't even mentioned, of course, all the Canadians in California, Arizona, or Florida, and also Alaska and the Northwest Territories and that whole area. So there's just a lot of intermingling and common interactions, at least, and I think identity there, much more so than many other regions of the world. And so let's not forget that. We're just so interwoven in terms of environmental issues, energy issues, agriculture, the media, all sorts of things. So I don't think identity is such a terrible problem. We're not that different, distinct, that we can't sort of try to get along and so forth, especially if Canada would try to understand us. What did I learn? Well, I sort of saw remnants of two perspectives which I think sadly have dominated international relations for a long time, the realist and idealist perspectives. So we get some realist talk about how 9/11 led to problems with the border from Alan Gottlieb and others. Then we had Bob Pastor, though, with a more idealist perspective of how we could solve that problem by the U.S. working through Mexico and so forth. We had Brad DeLong, who took a very realist perspective, it seemed to me, even going so far as to perhaps advocate conquest or union or something like that, and that would solve the problem. But then Rod DeBell had a much different perspective. He said economics has to change. We need new frameworks. We have to think about the Stiglitz-Sen way of accounting for the way the world works, and that we must start thinking that way. Then we had Janice Stein and Steve Weber tell us that Canada was really pretty much policy takers, another realist perspective. But Jennifer Jeff said, look, we can really work together on specific projects and things can be done through institutions and all sorts of new mechanisms. Tom Huffaker told us that oil sands or tar sands, I'm a little confused about what they're really called, heavy oil, too. Heavy oil. I love that idea. So heavy that it actually is solid. very interesting. That we just have to understand world markets and that there's a demand for that, and therefore they're going to be developed, and let's get on with it. But Dan Kamen, who then has a different perspective, says, no, we need new frameworks, new ways to thinking about the world. Catherine Harrison as well. We need new institutions, new frameworks again. Well, here, it seems to me the realists are focused very much often on federal-to-federal relationships, and the U.S. as hegemon, no question about it, and that's sort of and bilateralism, which comes maybe out of the bipolarism of the Cold War, and it's sort of the remnant of that everything's got to be sort of bilateral. Whereas the idealists talk about things like NGOs and civil society, states and provinces, and the role they can play, interestingly enough, firms, and even the way they could interact across the borders, and new frameworks, just new frameworks. And I actually think the new frameworks is a very important thing, certainly in the energy area, with the life cycle kinds of analyses, trying to account for things like carbon and so forth, the Sen-Stiglitz approach. There are new ways of thinking about how we measure what we do in the world, which may become increasingly important as we realize that the old ways of just saying let's maximize GNP are not the way to go. So I sort of like the idealist perspective, maybe because I'm an inveterate optimist and I see more optimism there. And perhaps to tell us where we should go in the future, we just need to pick some projects. It sure seems to me that energy and the smart grid and some of the things we talked about this morning, there's some projects there that sound really exciting and things that could be done. And if people were challenged to do them, maybe they could get done. I like Bob Pastor's project of saying, let's see if Mexico, the United States, and Canada can help deal with the problems of a country like Mexico, help Mexico solve some of its problems, partly because solving some of its problems will help us, both countries. And then the Arctic, which is another interesting big project. And maybe that's the right way to think about things, is somebody's got to start saying, let's think about some big projects that actually will benefit everybody if it's done right, and then let's embark upon those projects. And here, Canada could take the lead, it seems to me, in much the same way as Anne was talking about with respect to the border after 9/11. So I think it's more than just trying to understand me and us better, Anne. I think actually there's ways that leadership could make a big difference here, and we could actually go forward and do some really interesting and neat things. Thanks.
Well, let's turn it out to you folks. Pierre-Marc Johnson and Ruby Unger and Bob Pastor.
I found this to be a remarkable 2 days. What was, I wouldn't say mostly, but all the time, an intelligent conversation. Anne's passionate reflection on Canada-U.S. relations brings to my mind an analogy of there are things which are soft in law and things which are strong, and in a relationship between two countries like Canada and the United States, there are things that are soft and strong for both. And for Canada, what is strong is actually soft for the U.S. in many cases. The economic aspects of our relationship for us is fundamental, as you said it so well. I wouldn't say it's not important for the U.S., but it's not as important as other issues. And what I heard here for 2 days is that the three main issues, everything's in three, as you know, Descartes. The three main issues I've heard from U.S. participants here, interestingly, two refer to military, one refers to security. The concept of using NORAD to solve the Arctic issue is one which is framed not only in security and economic terms, but also in military terms. Secondly, Afghanistan. You can't be more military than that. And thirdly, Mexico is a matter of, as Anne, I think, pointed very well out, I mean, the fragility of Mexico and the problems at the border for the U.S. and the trade in drugs and le banditisme généralisé and trade in arms. It's a huge issue for the United States, to which we cannot be indifferent. I'm not sure exactly what we can do about that, but we can be around for a few things, probably. For the rest, for us, having an adequate relationship with our neighbors means being predictable. They should expect, I guess, that one out of every four issue we might decide not to be exactly on board, but that has to be a decision, not an accident. It's as simple as that. And I think sometimes things happen in Canadian foreign policies which are accidents, and we should never be in a situation of accident when we talk about the U.S. So I retain from that that hopefully, as we look at these three major issues that come out, and maybe two or three others, I'm sure, that we can also elaborate a strong case for our issues. And that's the way negotiations are made, I guess. And which brings me to think that we're in a constant state of negotiations with the United States. Thank you.
Thank you, Pierre-Marc. Before turning to Ruby Unger, I'd just like to drop a question on Pierre-Marc. Perhaps you could take it up later. Premier Johnson is currently negotiating a smart post-trade agreement for Quebec with France and with the European Union that will enter the area of regulatory convergence, mutual recognition, and all of the things that current trade agreements don't do. What I'd like to ask you, if you could take this up in a minute later, is could North America and the European Union triangulate in some way that does create, not as we heard yesterday, an opposition to China, but as a common civilization, democratic civilization, something that has a future, not in any federative sense, but as a common economic space. So I'll leave that with you. Ruby Unger.
My name is Ruby Unger. I'm an educational filmmaker, and I deal with broadcast issues, and I really appreciate, I'm honored to be able to ask this question of all of you. I am so impressed with what I have heard this last day and a half. And I've made a couple of notes because, you know, I asked yesterday, what is the 10-second elevator speech if you had someone's attention for that long? And it's because I am a filmmaker and I've had to pitch to our distributor, I want to do this. So I've heard complexity is the source of inaction, and I say it to all of us, simplicity is the source of action. Having worked with young children, I appeal to you for the children in your life. You are parents, you are aunts and uncles, you are grandparents, and you are brilliant. I have never been in such a group of really smart people because I am a former broadcaster. And thank you. And thank you. Thank you for that. And if you start with your children, with the young people, with the youth who are around you, and say to them, oh, you're a North American. I'm a North American. Yes, you're a North American. What's a North American? Well, it's Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Oh, why do I care about that? Well, because, and now we all know why, we are completely interdependent with one another. We are one continent. We are surrounded by a number of oceans that have very different degrees of temperature and viability. We know what that is. We know what that is. Kids will learn. They've learned that it's an orangutan, not an orangutan. They've learned that it's a sea star, not a starfish. They've learned to sneeze on their sleeves, not on their hands. We are dinosaurs. They are the future. They can be taught. Please teach them that they are North Americans and do it by example. Commit to the process. Use your institutions, your local governments, your NGOs, your communities, the family. Go deep before you go wide. Top down, I say bottoms up. And the best defense is a good offense, because I am a Green Bay Packer fan from way back. And we all know that war teaches geography. We are better than that. We can teach the right way to do it. Thank you.
This was a terrific closing to a great conference. Of course, Anne always brings me to my feet, but I think all of the presentations were great. And what I'd like to do actually is to focus in on one proposal that Charles made, because I think it's a potentially very important one, and suggests a slight modification that might bring us to a better way to approach the border security issue and the whole range of economic and climate issues. And that is, instead of turning to NORAD to take up the question of the Arctic and the maritime and security issues in the Arctic, how about turning to NORTHCOM? Now, NORTHCOM, as some of you know, was established right after 9/11. It was established independently of NORAD, and it was based on a very simple idea that had not occurred to any American until 9/11, and that is that we really didn't have any force. We had the third largest military force, army in the world, and the largest and strongest military force in the entire world, and we're stationed in 100 different sites all over the world, but we didn't have a plan to defend the United States. It's a little startling, but it's true. And so we then, with Homeland Security and the establishment of Northern Command, began to do that. Now, the problem with Northern Command, of course, is it started with the George W. Bush approach, which was we really didn't want to seriously entertain Canada and Mexico as being a part of it. We just had some preliminary discussions. Canada, for obvious reasons, was a bit ambivalent for its own reasons, and since the U.S. was ambivalent, it didn't happen. But now we have a little space. And we do have a Northern Command. And the question is whether the Northern Command can't really incorporate Mexico and Canada, can incorporate as its first project the Arctic, but also as a second project what we really have been grasping at in terms of the security perimeter. If a security perimeter works combined with a common external tariff, you have freed up the border in a way that nobody has even contemplated before, while at the same time maintaining a level of security that we wouldn't have had before as well. So I throw that idea out to revisit NORTHCOM and revisit it in a way that will incorporate the two neighbors, incorporate security perimeter, Arctic, as well as a new configuration on the border.
If any of us can answer that question, I lost the thread on NORTHCOM a few years ago. Maybe Kevin O'Shea, could you address that question? And I'd like to ask Dr. Griffiths if he could please address Charles Doran's point about NORAD in the Arctic and this NORTHCOM issue from the standpoint of everything that you discussed yesterday. But first, Kevin. Kevin O'Shea is the Minister for Political Affairs at the mighty Canadian Embassy in Washington.
And I've been taking assiduous notes because there's a lot of tremendous ideas here, and I'd like to thank the organizers for putting this together. But before, first of all, I guess I'll address NORTHCOM. I mean, NORTHCOM, I think as we all know, is an American military command. It's much like CENTCOM that deals with that part of the world in Asia, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Middle East. So it is a fundamentally, it's a U.S. military command. It would change the concept of that military command if you were to make it a trilateral institution. I don't rule out that you could do that, but I think it would take away the logic of why they created NORTHCOM in the first place. You have CENTCOM for South America. You've created a command, NORTHCOM, that is responsible for all U.S. military action in terms of North America. You could change it, but I think it would take away the logic as to why you put it there in the first place. Secondly, if I could just address some of the other, make some comments in terms of what some of the presentations here. And I think I was struck by Anne McClellan's remarks as well in terms of if we're wanting to play a special role with the United States, are we really in sync with a lot of the major preoccupations of this administration or our previous administrations? And if I could, I was just making a list in terms of what is preoccupying the current administration and how do we fit into that. Number one, North American perimeter. If they looked at their primary interest with Canada, it is in securing the North American perimeter. And we talk about the thickening of the border. In terms of people, the only thickening that has occurred is actually you have to present a secure document. That's about the only change that has happened. But the real change that has happened in terms of this administration or previous administration is how they are looking at people who come into U.S. or North America. And what systems have they put in place to check? Now, a lot of it has required getting a lot more information on people before they arrive. It has required a lot more information on people who are visa exempt. We don't have the same systems in place for those. So they ask, why haven't you got those kind of systems in place? Why aren't we having a certain number of entry requirements for people who do not require a visa for getting into Canada? And mind you, we have more countries that do not require a visa for coming into Canada. But even for those countries that we share, France, Britain, the Americans have now put in place requirements to get information before these people can even buy a ticket. They say to us, if there's an easier way to get into North America, there certainly is. You don't require the same requirements to get into Canada. So I don't think we're fundamentally addressing their concerns in terms of the North American perimeter. We could probably do that. They're eager for a dialogue on that, and it may make changes in the rest of North America. Afghanistan, we've heard, is the number one foreign policy priority of the president. He has come out with a very clear, enhanced strategy. And I think Paul Heinbecker said it the other day. We've said, yeah, listen to you. We're going to ramp up to, and we are ramping up to 2011, but after that, regardless of where NATO is on that, we're out of the game. Mexico, I think we've heard, I think it is probably a blind spot in terms of Canada, but it is certainly a security issue for the United States. Are we playing into that? There are other issues that obviously are big concerns for the U.S. that we can't play into that much. Iran, Middle East. There are a number of other ones, though, that we can, and I think we are. Nuclear nonproliferation, democracy, democracy support, human rights, international governance. But I think it going back to what the discussion that has taken place here, I think in terms of Canadian interests, we have to look much more closely in terms of what are really the preoccupations in terms of this this administration. Do they fit with our interests? And if they do, what is an active role we can play?
Thank you. That's a great service, Kevin. I want to thank Henry Brady, too, for the realist-idealist breakdown, which actually made a lot of sense to me. Dr. Griffiths, could you address the big Arctic point, and then we'll go back to another round of questions.
It seems it's a great idea, I think, that Charles has suggested, that we look at NORAD as one way of dealing with Canada-U.S. security problems in the region. And these have to do, this problem has to do with the Northwest Passage. That's actually what you're talking about, principally. And there are other things we can do, but there is this stumbling block of the passage. NORAD is one way to approach it, but there are problems with NORAD, and principally because Canada decided not to go into missile defense, the whole impetus and the force behind NORAD these days is not really adding up to much. This is not a strong base. It would have to be rebuilt. Whether NORTHCOM could be expanded to into trilateral standing and still be north, I'm not sure. There are ways of talking about this, and I think, Charles, you're raising some really very interesting issues. At the same time, there is the matter of the perimeter, which I think is really vital to the discussion of this entire meeting. How far can we go with the perimeter, and what are the costs or some of the questions that have to be asked? It seems to me that from a homeland security point of view in the United States, the idea of running an international strait through the Arctic waters of North America is not very good. You're going to have all kinds of people coming through quite freely. You've, in fact, run a line right through the perimeter that should really be extending out to Alert and the uppermost part of Ellesmere Island. That perimeter should be solid all the way around. Instead, therefore, I would think that the Homeland Security people will have an interest in this. The Navy, though, will have a U.S. Navy will have another interest. That is, they want straits and mobility, and the Navy will want to see the Northwest Passage as an international strait. So who is going to prevail? And are there ways that Canada can work this thing out to mutual advantage? One way is to stay with where we are, which is an arrangement, not of disagreement, I think, as Charles has suggested, but Canada and the U.S. agree to disagree. We have a managed disagreement. We get along. We find ways to obfuscate and carry on as friends. I think that's my guess at the moment where we're going to go. Thank you.
Please, Mr. Croft.
Anne McClellan, in her speech, mentioned the name of Jeff Rubin and his rather interesting view of the world. And it seems to me, looking at the panel we just had on energy and climate change, that Canada and the United States are two countries that share a continent but actually live in two different worlds. That Anne mentioned Jeff Rubin, and I'm sure Tom Huffaker would agree with this, a view of the world with not enough carbon, not enough fuel resources. We will be facing in the near term an energy crisis, to which Canada holds an answer that is secure, not the whole answer, but part of it, in the oil sands of Alberta. And the other worldview that was, I think, described pretty well by Dr. Kamen, is a world of too much carbon, where we must pick and choose which carbon we're going to use and what should be left on the ground. And so the question I have is really two parts. One is, if the two countries could really agree, or if Canada and California could agree on what world we really do live in, would there really be any difference in the perspectives? Or would we suddenly fall into agreement and this whole dispute would disappear? And the other is, Why isn't there any research funding for that? There's an amazing lack of research funding for determining the magnitude of the world's fossil fuel resources. And that might be a fairly small funding compared to what the Alberta Technology Fund is going to do. And it might open some eyes about real problems and bring out some answers that, that are badly needed if there's a dispute over what world we even live in.
Thank you, Mr. Croft. We'll try and find an answer. Perhaps Mr. Huffaker could take that up. Madam, I think you were next.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you very much for having this conference. My name is Omawali Fowles, and I'm a PhD candidate in the School of Public Health. My areas of interest were very much piqued by panel number 5. However, I wasn't able to attend panel 1 or panel 6 today. And I wanted to ask you if the panel would entertain a notion of an expanded view of North Americanism or an expanded view of the Americas, given the kinds of immigration patterns that have been operative between the United States and Canada. The United States also has a border with Central America that seems to have been overlooked in panel number 6. And I wanted to ask that longitudinally, if you view immigration from the 18th, 19th centuries, when African-American people were escaping from slaveholding United States prior to 1865 and moving into Canada from crossing that border, then you have what I would consider an intra-American or an intra-North American immigration that gave you an African population, which is still very present, I understand. And then there's also the addition of African people coming out of the Caribbean, both the Francophone-speaking Caribbean as well as the English-speaking Caribbean, who have populated your country quite prolifically, so much so that now your governor general is actually an African American, an African woman, Michelle Jean. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. And so I think that my question has to do with the concept of panel 1, meaning culture, identity, and social contract. Mr. McClellan's comments kind of piqued my interest because she's had experience with Native Americans who are non-statist persons out of Montreal who have had fights with various and sundry real estate brokers over the years about whether or not a golf court was going to be constructed on their lands and on their Native American
lands.
We lived
through it. Just...
Did you live through that? Did they? I hope. But in any case, what I'm asking is, would you entertain the notion of an expanded
definition
non-European stock? Where are their policy voices on these issues of energy, environment, national security, and immigration? That was my question. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a simple answer to your question. In terms of the geographic delimitation of what we were talking about, we did discuss this morning the issue of Central America, and indeed the Caribbean. You introduced the Caribbean, and we agreed that you got to move serially. I think the thought was you deepen before you widen, and that was the outcome as far as geography is concerned. As far as ethnicity is concerned, Dr. Citra and Dr. Johnston yesterday morning discussed identity, but they did so from the standpoint of everybody who lives in the two countries concerned, whether Native Canadian, Native American, African, Caribbean origin, or so on and so forth. And there was quite an amount of differentiation, I would say. There was an attempt to differentiate opinion among immigrants, recent immigrants, and so on and so forth. So there was an assiduous effort to do, I think, what you were doing, okay? And I'd urge you to read their paper and then go and harangue Dr. Citrin in Moses Hall, okay?
Yeah, I kind of hang out in Moses Hall now. So
yeah, he's there.
I know.
And I don't know if Michelle is still in the room, but Michelle is ready. Yes, sir. Voilà, Michelle est là. Michelle is ready to be harangued at any moment on these issues. So I thank you very much for the question. I mean, it's perceptive, it's real. I think we tried to answer it yesterday, but I'm glad you came in to ask it. And I wanted Jana Stein to talk, because I bet she's going to talk about Afghanistan. I'm not sure.
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay.
Not unless you push me to the wall. I actually want to rephrase something that Anne said in a more extreme way than Anne did, because Anne was polite.
So unusual.
I actually heard Anne saying, and I think it comes out of our discussion, that we in Canada think we have a special relationship with the United States, and historically we did for a long period of time, but that is not actually the way the United States thinks about us much anymore, if they think about us at all, and that there are probably another 50 countries that think they have a special relationship with the United States in Washington. And if that's the case, that's a major policy challenge for us. It's a Canada-U.S. challenge, it's a North American challenge, but it starts from, and I think it leads to two sets of policy problems that are interesting to pursue. One, Anne put squarely on the table. What's on the U.S. agenda? What matters to the United States? Where can we, in fact, work with the United States? Where do interests converge? Where can we help the United States? Because the United States remains centrally important to Canada. That remains what we would call a brute fact. Whatever else we do, the United States remains centrally important. But we don't ask that question quite that way. To be blunt, and that's what I heard Anne saying, we whine a lot, because the United States isn't paying attention to us, and we're very special. And to the extent that we continue to do this, it actually gets in the way of doing the policy analysis that Kevin talked about and others, and looking for areas of policy convergence. So that's my first general comment. And I think it would clear the air if we could forget our specialness for a while. The second thing is the way we talked about the border throughout the whole conference. And we actually talked about it, and I let off, so I bear a share of the crime here. We talked about it in a very 19th century way, the border, because it's very real, very present. And it's thicker not only because we have to change our documents, that's not the big issue. It's thicker because we have to wait very long. And people don't like waiting in an impatient age. It's annoying. Yeah. So it's that sense of thickness that we've all experienced. Now, that's true when we're moving people, goods, and services across the border. But it's actually not true if we're thinking about climate change. It's not true if we're thinking about disease. Because SARS moved across the border, H1N1 moved across North American borders, and believe it or not, it did not need a smart card or a passport, and it didn't wait in line, and it didn't do any of the things that we talked about. So the worlds that we live in, some parts of it have borders, which are getting thicker, but other very important parts of it don't have borders. And again, if we pick the policy issues, we focus on, as I suspect Kevin will, focus on that part of the border that we are trying to fix because it is important to us to fix, but also understand how many policy issues we share with the United States and Mexico, where the border is absolutely irrelevant to the conversation, and look for the opportunities to work on those policy issues. In a very clear-eyed way, I think we can move the goalposts forward.
Thank you very much.
Can I respond?
Follow up on one example that Janice used, H1N1. Correct me if I'm wrong, Kevin, or perhaps Colin, you know about this, but H1N1, I think, first identified in Mexico, or very close to first. And it is viewed as one of the great success stories trilaterally in I would say, the past decade, because Canada and the U.S. with Mexico, put resources into Mexico. They identified what was going on early. And then that not only inured to the benefit of the peoples of the three countries, that collaboration was shared with the rest of the world through the WHO and elsewhere, and made a, as I understand it, significant difference in terms of early identification of the strain, early development of various kinds of vaccinations. So it's a great example, Janice, of what you're talking about here and how the three countries can work together. It's not about borders. It's shared interest and make a difference for the world, not only our own peoples.
Thank you. Charles Duran wants to respond to Franklin.
But first, I want to respond to Janice. Canada does have a special relationship with the United States. Just don't expect to get something immediately and directly and that you can calculate and that it's always got to have a concrete meaning. The fact that Canada has troops in Afghanistan, has taken casualties, has been a serious participant for whatever reason, because you're part of NATO, because you are an ally of the United States, because you think, in fact, it's your responsibility. It doesn't matter what the explanation is. As far as Americans are concerned, it's made a huge difference. And over time, that's going to have consequence. That's going to have positive consequences. But you can't just extract that on the basis of something specific and immediate. I wanted to respond to Frank's very, very useful and interesting comments again. I think he gave me an American response. And what I want to do is to respond to him with a Canadian response. All right? He gave me an American response in the sense that he's saying, well, you know, let's just agree to disagree, which is kind of what the policy's been. Let's just be pragmatic. Let's just let it go, and so on, which is often the American response to these matters. I have to say this. If that would, in fact, be where things were left, and if political policymakers were not forced by public opinion and other things to move forward in a different direction, that would be fine. But I think, in fact, it won't just stay there. And that's why I believe a Canadian solution is necessary. Maybe it involves NORTHCOM, but I'm not sure. I know there's a lot of discussion about the Mexican-U.S. border there. I think that what we have is the historic example of our historical example of something that worked extremely well, that in fact has purposely created an extension of a maritime sort to deal with these situations. I just gave something of the same talk to the Canadian Defense Association sessions. And in fact, there was a long debate and discussion there, which was, you might find, there was quite a surprising positive response to this. I think we need to follow a Canadian solution to this problem, which should have a more of an institutional content. And it seems to me that NORAD is one of the possible institutional routes that would hit off more difficult problems down the road.
Okay. Look, Pierre-Marc, if you would dire quelque chose, I'd like to ask before he quit, is Ambassador Gottlieb still there?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you, Alan, if you would like to give us a benediction or something. First, can I say something just personal about this special relationship thing? I'm a hybrid. My mother was born in Los Angeles. I have grown up partly in the United States, partly in Canada. I went to an American university, but as a hockey player. My lifelong friends, and one of them has been kind enough to come and join us here, whom I've known for 40 years, have never understood my pretense that I'm a Canadian, but I am. My point is that that applies to millions and millions and millions of people, as Henry said, and that is a special relationship. That does not happen to Greeks or the French. I guess it does sort of to the Irish. I'll give you that one. So I do, that does not, however, apply to jurisdictional issues with respect to states, and that's what we're talking about. I think Canadians confuse the sentiment, okay, with the policies. And it is a fact. that we are, in fact, in many, many respects, whether we're African-Canadian from the Caribbean or whether we're Chinese-Canadian, we do have a rather unique relationship to the other people on this continent, and that's what makes a community. And I just thought I'd leave it there and hope that we can do something with it in terms of what Ruby Younger was saying. Now, I don't know who should go first. Pierre-Marc, perhaps you first, if you could say something. And then I'd ask Prime Minister Clark if you would like to say something. And then, please, Ambassador Gottlieb.
I understand you wanted me to refer to the European.
Well, not necessarily. Anything you want, okay.
Well, okay, I think I've talked enough. But I was very impressed by all of what I heard, particularly this afternoon's panel. Thank you very much, all of you. I'll revisit complexity is the mother of inaction. I will say complexity, and I think there's lots of complexity in what we heard today. Can be a great stimulation for the mind. But it does take, and I think what's lacking presently in the establishment of a Canadian foreign policy, which is consistent with the United States, is a certain level of public engagement on certain realities. And that foreign policy is not about a series of independent, silo, separated decisions. There's not a sense these days that all of this comes up together in something which is really consistent. I am sure many people are working on that consistency on a daily basis at the Department of Foreign Affairs, but I'm not sure that at the political level this has become convincing. I'm not saying it's not there in the minds of the politicians or certain of them, but it's obviously not very convincing for the average citizens when they look at what is our foreign policy in Canada. The second comment is about the North Americanitude, the North American aspect of what should happen to us. I think it's, we say in French, souhaitable. Please find me desirable. Although desire brings you to soft porn stuff, I hope not. I think it's desirable. And I think it should be engaged with two priorities. One is to what extent, from a Canadian perspective, that can serve our relationship also with the United States when we're addressing Mexican issue. And the second aspect is to build on the fact, and I heard that, I believe, from Henry earlier, that this government in the United States is open to institutional building, is not anti-institution, as the other one was, quite obviously, and I was witness of that many times. And I think Canada has to really progress in that direction to try to solidify some of these around a few projects, including the Northwest Passage. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pierre-Marc. Mr. Clark, s'il vous plaît.
I'll be very quick. This has been extremely valuable. Not a surprise, I guess, given its auspices. But I think what is interesting about it is that it is happening in a sort of a vacuum. There has not been much discussion of this kind. And I think the important point to bear in mind is Abe Lowenthal's suggestion that what is essential now is to agree on some process that moves this forward so it is not just another conversation that taught us something and interested us all. And I'm sure that that will be embraced with the same efficiency and vision that the organization of the conference was. On my behalf, thank you very much.
Thank you, Joe.
Jeremy, as the mic goes over to Alan, just a comment. In his wonderful memoirs, Washington Diaries, he writes about a meeting he had with Dick Darman, I guess about 25 years ago, and up at the White House. And he goes in, and Darman says, I've got two things to tell you, good news and bad news. So quintessential Canadian style, Alan says, well, give me the bad news to begin with. And so Darman turns to the ambassador and says, well, the bad news is Ronald Reagan really likes you guys. So Alan says, oh, well, what's the good news? And the good news, Darman says, is you Canadians are too stupid to realize it. Well, I like to think that we've learned something in 25 years, that we're smarter now, that we've actually got ideas for a plan and take it forward. But I pass to the maestro and say, have we learned anything in 25 years, Alan?
Yeah. Well, I think the ground has shifted under us. And that's what concerns me. I, you know, the subject of our conference, and I think I congratulate you. I think it was a great meeting. Was North American futures, and as I have lived and evolved with this subject, I do believe that the best solution for Canada would be to deepen the integration we have. We're sort of three quarters integrated. And to deepen our relationship and to create a common economic space to which I think Mexico can be a part, perhaps whether sequentially or contemporaneously, so that we have a common economic space and a common economic, common security perimeter. So that is my vision. That's what I feel deeply. If I am pessimistic, and I suppose I am to some extent, is that but things change and nothing is permanent. But I doubt that there are ears in Washington that would hear us if we were to pursue such an initiative of trying to now deepen the relationship. I find, as I said in my comments, I don't think there is a strategic view of Canada in Washington today. And I don't see that changing. I think we see an administration here who, if the sense that they identified any view at all, it came out during the long campaign in a very negative view towards NAFTA and towards towards the degree of integration we have today. And I don't see that turning around. And therefore, I think that one of the most basic premises of Canadian foreign policy may be sorely tested in the years to come.
Thank you very much, Alan. Yes, of course. I'd like to say again personally, I'd like to thank everybody who came to this, particularly from afar. This is not the end. Dick Johnson and Jack Citrin would like to speak as we close the conference.
I want to be very brief here because it's been a long day. I'd like to start by saying that it really takes something special for me to spend a Saturday in March not watching college basketball. And actually, I don't regret missing a bunch of games in order to have been as enlightened as I was by today's three excellent panels. There are many people to thank. I'm going to start with Jeremy Kinsman for all his work in bringing this wonderful event together, and also Jeremy, in his masterful way, is going to prepare a summary report on this. And one of our next steps is going to be to try and follow up on the suggestions of several people here, is how to communicate, sort of in Chatham House way, what was said here in a way that it can go beyond this room. Next thing I'd like to do, and I hope you'll join me in really thanking the people who did all the hard work for this conference. I know Alan Unger is still here. Bravo. And the assistant director of my own institute, IGS, Mark Levin. Where are you, Mark? And then I'd like to specially thank two young ladies who've given up 2 days, and Corey's given up time with her three children. Corey Flynn, who's there. And also Maggie. Why don't you stand up, Maggie Eisenberg? Really, without you, this would not have been as smoothly conducted and enjoyable event. I want to say a couple last things because I want to make a contribution to my current country, United States of America, improving its dysfunctional political system. And this is that Henry will agree with this, that many of our colleagues at Berkeley, even though they love being part of the university, they want to have as little to do with students as possible. Now, Henry is an exception to this because he teaches a lot and he loves to teach, and so do I. And every 2 years, I teach a course called Introduction to American National Politics, and the subtitle is Democracy, American Style, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. And students always ask me at some point, well, Professor Citrin, are you a Democrat or are you a Republican? I say, no, I'm the founder and president of my own party. And they say, well, what party is that? And I say, it's called the Anarcho-Fascist Party. And they say, that seems like a contradiction in terms. I say, no, it's very simple. The anarcho part is, don't tell me what to do. And the fascist part is, I'm going to tell you what to do. And maybe that's something that fits into the Canadian-American relationship. But anyway, I'm going to abandon that party as a result of being so enlightened here. And Anne, I want to thank you for emphasizing to those of us who don't study international relations, but the grubby domestic politics world, is that domestic politics has a lot to do with international relations. And I feel that, you know, my life has some meaning. I'm giving up the anarcho-fascist party, and I'm forming a new party, which I'm going to be the campaign manager for, and it's called the FCOP party, which stands for Former Canadian Officials Party, because what we've heard from you here is so, I think, enlightening and brilliant and well-spoken and just so in some ways inspiring as compared to our own political discourse. And now you're going to say to me, well, what's the problem? We don't have Social Security cards. We aren't citizens. We can't run for elective office. I say, no problem. This is one of the trilateral issues here. I'll drive down to San Jose, and for $225 each, I'll get you a Social Security card and a passport. And frankly, that might thin out the border for you. Okay, I'm going to say one last thing before turning over to Dick. My wife is scowling at me. I am going to pay for those remarks. But anyway, now I'm going to turn it over to Richard.
Well, so one of the themes of the conference has been dysfunctionality. I'm struck by the fact that we have dysfunctional anthems. In Canada, we can't agree on the wording. We have a momentary initiative to change it that is beaten back. Of course, this country has an anthem that is magnificent but unsingable. Starts with a C major triad and then goes nuts. Covers two octaves and has so much modulation that it attracts melissima, that thing that covers bad singing. So if we can't get our anthem straight, what can we get straight? Well, one thing we can get straight is sort of friendship across the two borders. I mean, this, I think, illustrates actually in its own way what Colin mentioned, the hidden wiring. Some of this wiring was more hidden than other bits, but it started out. Well, I can't actually say how it really started out, because I suspect that Germany was at the germination of this thing before I became aware of it. But it, for me at least, it started out in late February. A voicemail from Jack, was I interested in a conference with UBC co-sponsorship? And it seemed pretty clear that Jack wanted me to say yes, because the alternative would be to have some central Canadian university be the co-sponsor. So it was pretty important, obviously, that this happened. It built on friendships that go back an embarrassingly long way. Henry and I are basically each other's best friend. Jack may have forgotten, but he was present on my 30th birthday. I had carefully suppressed the thought that it was my 30th birthday, and we were running in Central Park, and he turned to me and said, Richard, how old are you? I was forced to confront the fact that I was 30 that very day. So it goes back a long way. And what we've done, I think, or what we're, for us, part of the point of this whole thing was to kind of make this wiring between our two universities less hidden, to build on these relationships, institutionalize them, and make something more out of this that would then take on a life of its own. And it would appear, boy, has it done that. So, I mean, one of the things that, Jack and I were eager to insist on, really, was that the format not be just the great and the good, but that it also have academics, and that academics would be part of the agenda setters of the operation, but not that they would own it solely. We fancy that our involvement may be part of the story that gives this thing some enduring value. But I think that how exactly we give it enduring value is a question that we haven't yet settled, and I have a sense over the last couple of days that in some ways this thing was bigger than us and kind of got out of our control, so to speak. That's a good thing. But what that means and how we actually turn that into something real actually remains to be settled. So I think we have, over the next bit, a considerable amount of reflection on practice amongst ourselves, including amongst the group of us, a diverse group, that organized it, in terms of what is the optimal mix of participants, what's the structure of the presentations, what is the relative role, in particular, of academics and non-academics, and finally, what's the frequency of these things. This is the first Berkeley British Columbia Symposium. We hope it becomes a regular, recurring event, but we're actually not sure what the frequency will be. These things don't come, they're not free, and most of the money comes from our respective institutions, not from governments or private sources, though that may change. So there's a question of how much capacity we have to do this and how frequently we can turn this into how frequently we can have these events. But this is also kind of the Sochi moment. We are, Jack is figuratively handing me the three flags to carry to Vancouver. The next one will be at UBC. What it's on is an interesting question. I think that amongst ourselves in talking about it, we actually thought that the obvious theme was a kind of an Asia-Pacific theme, particularly reflecting the coast that we're on and the metropolitan areas that these universities are part of, although I also sense that there's a lot of desire inside this meeting for momentum coming out of its themes. The Arctic, for example, I mean, this is another moment to remember Tom. I mean, the Arctic panel is on the program because Tom argued for it. We didn't really think of it as part of the initial thing. So there is this whole question of the Arctic and how it could be one of the functional areas that structures an aspect of the North American relationships. There is the question of Mexico. The Mexican panel, Let's face it, it was here as an afterthought. The fact that it was an afterthought speaks volumes about our basically Canadian-American, but though in this case perhaps more Canadian-limited vision. I think that, speaking personally, I sort of saw this pretty much as the way Anne described the Canadian reflex. It's a border issue. We didn't want to get into this in the first place, but now we realize that we can't think that way. But whether either of those topics would be the next conference or a parallel conference or a whole differently organized thing, I don't know. But I invite your thoughts to any of us. Our emails are easily accessible on any of those questions. Kinds of participants, indeed names of participants, structure of the event, frequency of the event, and topics for the future, because although we haven't settled yet whether it's going to be next year or 2 years from now, our settled intention is that this become a recurring feature, an institutionalized relationship between Berkeley and UBC, and that we just do more of this. So thank you all for coming. I'm done.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.